Fala, Rani. Govinda, Bala, Radhe, Govinda, Bala, Radhe. Thank you.
Thank you, Bhagwan Das, and thank you all for being here. Again, with great joy, great pleasure, I want to welcome you to this, our meeting on the Path to the Beloved, as we continue our exploration of love focused on God.
So the title of this class, Loving Your Way to Awakening, is purposeful, because the word awakening implies that the path of love is not just about feeling good or even feeling great or even feeling loving. It is also about awakening to who you are beyond your body, mind, personality, awakening to the love awareness that's your true self. And that's what makes it a path. You know, and as that happens, you will also start to realize something very radical and mysterious, which is that it is not you as an individual who loves. It's love itself who loves through you. Let's just get naked about it. It's the divine itself that loves through you. And here's a clue, that one of the things that we discover on this path is that the practices of bhakti, which we're going to go into in a lot of detail next week, are really arose as a way of reverse engineering the actual felt experience of what we could call spontaneous bhakti or self-realization in the form of bhakti. Bhakti is a practice. It's also a state of realization. The first group of sutras that we're talking about this last week and this week actually describe the state of realization. And much of the rest of the book describes the practices, which are really a way of training yourself to behave, to act, to feel as you would if you actually were in the realized state of love. And the idea is that as we reverse engineer the process of devotion, it actually allows us to enter devotion by enacting it. So part of it, you know, and this is an as-if practice, but it's not fake. It's not fake it till you make it. Because when you're on the path, what you do is you contemplate what the state of awakened devotional love is, and this is why Narada starts by telling us what the fully realized state feels like. Then you practice enacting the different aspects of that state, and very often when you get drawn onto this path, it's because you have had an experience of what it feels like when you get deeply immersed in chant, or what it feels like when you contemplate a particular form, whether it's a human form that kindles big love in you, or a literal divine form like Krishna or Christ. Here's an example that I think quite a few of you will recognize, which is actually what made me realize what is actually happening when we practice. When I first began having spontaneous experiences of love arising, of an open heart, it was always accompanied by a kind of realization. First of all, there would be very strong feelings of gratitude, because it's so clear, as you know, that this feeling of divine love is a complete gift. There's really nothing you can do to make it arise, though there's lots of things you can do to, you know, kind of coax it into existence. So I would find myself saying, thank you, and oh my God, you're so great. And you know, as Anne Lamott once said very wisely, there's three great forms of prayer. One of them is thank you, the other is help, the other is wow. And essentially, when you're in the state of love, the only thing you can do, the only thing you can say really is thank you and wow. As it turns out, as we all know, gratitude practice turns out to be one of the great strategies for kindling a state of tenderness, or turning a state of unlove into a state that feels more loving. Loving kindness practice is another one. And so is deliberately shifting your vision, your thought state, from judgment to appreciation, as actually Ram Dass writes in that very beautiful quote that Karen sent us on the listserv, and I'll send it out to you in the homework in case you're not on the listserv. So a lot of bhakti practices deliberately cultivating certain attitudes, one of which is that love involves a shift of perception. One of my spiritual teacher friends, Mark Goffney, says that love is a perception. That is, to love somebody is to look at them with the willingness to perceive both their vulnerability and their unique greatness. And another teacher friend of mine always says that love is an action. That is, that even when you don't feel warm and open, you could open your heart just a little bit by doing something nice and doing something generous, and that will start to kindle love in you. In fact, one of the best ways to work with your feeling of being unloved and lonely is to do something generous for somebody without expecting anything back, which is hard, actually, because normally when we do something nice for somebody, we expect them to reciprocate. But the fact is that both these practices, all these practices, are expressions of how divine love, bhakti, when it's freed from its veils, naturally sees us and others. And so by practicing looking at others with loving eyes or behaving kindly when we don't feel like it, we actually prime our psyche to open past our various blocks to the warmth that's really there behind the veils. So a lot of the bhakti path is about recognizing and working with the barriers to love through making subtle attitudinal shifts. The word in Sanskrit for attitude is bhava, kind of the feeling state that you can kindle. You practice the bhava of thinking and behaving as if you were in love. And by doing that, you allow love to arise in the space. And then, by the way, you have to refuse to beat yourself up when you can't, when you're not feeling loving or when you do something to blow it. But as you do this, it becomes clear that love is not something that you only feel when someone meets your needs. You start to understand that love is actually a point of view. It's an intention. And that just as you can start, just as you can decide to practice jnana yoga by becoming aware of awareness, by practicing being aware of awareness, which is, you know, kind of a way of reverse engineering one of the experiences of enlightenment. You can also notice that when you decide to see someone with the eye of non-judgment, to see their struggles, to realize that they can't help being who they are and that there's greatness and beauty in them, when you can do that, notice how your underlying feeling towards them will open, will expand, will take on this warmth that is really the essence of the feeling of love. So what we're looking for is that softening with its accompanying feeling of tenderness. That's what we cultivate in the bhakti path. As we soften, the love that's hidden begins to be revealed. In today's class, we're going to be invoking the highest form of bhakti, as Narada does in the first group of sutras. But we're also going to practice to look at how it is that we can apply this to our so-called normal or so-called ordinary relationships. So the question is then, how is it if right now, as we begin, you can make the intention to view yourself and the people you're aware of in this moment and whom you might become aware of in the course of our time together, if you can view yourself and the other people in your life with a perception of their intrinsic value, if you can intend to see with the eye of love, actually take your stance in that intention, and especially to see yourself in that way. And when you do that, you're actually moving into what I believe is the most exquisite aspect of awakening, the awakening that lets you realize that you are the beloved, that you are the radical presence at the heart of reality, and that the beloved is actually living and seeing through your eyes, even when you don't know that you're being seen with the eye of love. So again, as we said last week, if love is too big a word, try using acceptance or tenderness or welcoming or that neutral Buddhist term, kindly regard. And realize that, as Rumi says, I have been forgetful every moment, but never has this flowing towards me slowed or stopped. So take a deep breath and let yourself flow into an upright posture, a comfortable posture, and settle into the awareness of this shared space that we're in together. Find yourself in the circle on the shores of the great blue lake of consciousness, Lake Manasarovar, high in the Himalayan mountains, surrounded by snow-capped peaks. It's just before twilight, it's magic hour. And the atmosphere here is very still and laden with love and aspiration. And all of us are here sitting together. And if you like, you can, in your imagination, invite other people in your life to join us there, to imagine the circle expanding, to include friends and family members and beloveds and even some people that you don't actually like very much, just allowing them to come into the circle. And with your eyes closed and your sense of being present here with all of us, become aware that you're holding in your hands a tea light and that using your magical siddhi of lighting fires with your forefinger, you can light that candle. And holding it in your hands, create your intention for this class, for this evening, for this moment. And then place your candle on the water. And we'll chant the opening mantras, the mantras that invoke the Guru, with the words, the Guru is pure consciousness, Chaitanyam, eternal, peaceful, beyond space, stainless, beyond all levels of awareness. I bow to that Guru. And then the mantras invoking the love of Krishna. I adore the Sweet One, the source of supreme bliss, whose grace makes a dumb person eloquent and a cripple cross mountains. And finally, the mantras invoking the presence of the goddess, the supremely auspicious one, eternally united with Shiva, with God, the golden one, giver of boons, refuge of all, adorned with the eye of supreme wisdom. Om Chaitanyam Shashvatam Shantam Vyomatitam Niranjanam Nada Bindu Kalachitam Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Mukham Karoti Vachalam Pangam Langayate Girim Yakripa Tamaham Vande Paramananda Madhavam Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Triambake Gauri Narayani Namostute Om. We ask that our practice be of benefit to all beings, that all beings know happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask to experience equanimity beyond grasping, hatred, and dullness. And we ask to know the equality of all that lives. Feeling into the flow of the breath, begin to be aware that with every breath, love is flowing towards you. Feel that you're being welcomed. And let the inhalation begin to draw breath in through your pores, as if every breath is infused with the shakti of acceptance, of welcome, of inclusion. Now feel that you're being seen by a loving gaze, the gaze of someone who adores you, someone who accepts you completely, who knows everything there is to know about you, and fully holds and embraces you, who wants and needs nothing from you, who only wants to love you. You may have another human in your life who sees you like this, but even if you don't, know that the beloved sees you right now with this total, unchanging affection, and recognize that this affection that's flowing towards you is carried in the breath. Every breath is drawing it in through the nostrils, through the heart, through the pores. And just let yourself relax in the awareness that you are seen and known and breathed and loved by the great beloved. As we unpack the different forms that love takes, what we start to realize is that every one of us is going to approach the great love in our own way. And we're going to probably approach it differently at every moment. You know, in couples work, as many of you know, couples coaches or couples therapists often talk about styles of love, how for some people love is expressed through giving gifts, for others by fixing things for you or sticking up for you when you're being attacked. And when your style of loving is different than your partner's, it can take some adjustment to realize that you're actually being loved. So in other words, we don't always know exactly what love looks like because we're often blocked by our feeling of what love should look like. So the mystery, the beloved, has infinite ways of loving you. Sometimes her way of loving you is to just shower you with sweetness. And sometimes her way of loving you is to put you through challenges that force you to grow. Sometimes it's through giving you the realization that you're protected, sometimes by showing you beauty in the midst of pain, sometimes by opening your heart to the suffering in the world, sometimes by giving you insight into your own nature. So love has room for everything, for people with enormous hearts, for the helpless, the confused, the needy, and also for people who aren't even interested in universal love, but just want their family or their partner to be sweeter. So all of this is part of the mix here. We're working with two texts, mainly, two truth-laden texts, the Bhakti Sutras of Narada, the Bhagavad Gita, and we're also working with the poems of Rumi and some of the other great Sufi realizers. And layered into these sutras, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later today, is one of the most important truths of Bhakti Yoga, which is that our relationships are pointers to the inner beloved. Because God is in everything, what that means is that everybody actually is a form of the beloved, even if it seems to be just the opposite. So, you know, there's a song I really like by Benji and Heather Wertheimer, who are wonderful Kirtanwala's devotional musicians, and it says, because the one I love lives inside of you, I lean as close to you as I can. Because the one I love lives inside of you, I lean as close to you as I can. So what they're talking about is this meeting place between personal love and direct love for spirit, for the mystery. What I'm trying to say here is that our human relationships are not less godly than our relationships with Krishna or the goddess or Buddha or Christ. They're actually the laboratory in which we learn about what love feels like and also about what blocks our love. So all of our relationships are stepping stones. And I think one of the things that I've been seeing on the listserv and that most of us feel at one time or another is that we're not fulfilled in every type of love. You know, maybe we weren't fully mothered, or our father wasn't able to give us the blessing we needed to thrive in the world. Or we might feel that we ourselves don't have enough love to give, that we're not, you know, we don't fully love our partner or our child, or that we haven't been able to make our love big enough so that we can actually bear the pain of a homeless person or even of someone who physically threatens us. And I know that, you know, when I read my journals from my teens and 20s, I realized that even though I had earned a PhD in romantic infatuation, when I really looked at my own heart, and I was very aware of it at the time, I felt that I didn't have any idea how to love. That feeling of not loving enough or not receiving enough love is, of course, sourced in our childhood because our parents often didn't know how to see us or nurture us in a truly loving way. And it's a truism of modern psychology, because it's true that our understanding about God, our feeling about God, about the divine, are very much connected to how we were parented. Your view of the Supreme Being, assuming that you actually recognize that there is such a thing as a supreme being is going to be to some extent based on your early experience. So if you were if your parents were judgmental or critical, or like many modern parents, expected performance out of you, expected you to earn their love even if they didn't intend that, they often gave us that impression, then our version of God will be judgmental. And if they were indulgent, you'll tend to think that God is just waiting to give you another hug or another scoop of ice cream. So from a psychodynamic point of view, it often happens, we often get very discouraged in the bhakti path because somehow we believe that we have to settle all our trauma, work out our self-esteem issues, heal our wounds, before we can accept the fact that the universe is actually in love with us and that all we really have to do is receive it. And when we begin to get that, as several of you said on the listserv, all these feelings, the trauma, the self-esteem issues, the wounds, begin to be soothed. It doesn't happen overnight, but it happens over time. I can tell you this from my own experience. So touching into the love of spirit makes you realize that whether or not you've had the karma to receive or express love in all the possible human ways, still, love is around you. And it's subtle enough to seep into even the closed-off corners of the heart. And it has that capacity to heal the unlove, which is probably the greatest cause of human suffering and conflict. So, as I said, in this class, we're going in a couple of directions. We're going to continue our discussion of the first group of sutras, which describe the goal of the path, and which will lead us into the discussion for next week on bhakti practice. And then we're going to use one of Rumi's great mystical poems to take another perspective on the path, to look at bhakti as a methodology for moving past the veils that hide the real source of love. So always we're going to be returning to this initial meditation, noticing the breath, opening ourselves to feeling that every breath is bringing love into our body. And whether the breath feels like it's coming in through the nostrils and moving out of the nostrils, or whether you have the practice of letting the breath flow in through the nostrils, down through the heart, nonetheless, love is flowing through the breath. Narada Bhakti Sutras and also the Bhagavad Gita want us to understand that bhakti is a yoga. And what we mean when we say that it's a yoga is that it has a certain goal and it requires a certain rigor. In fact, Narada in the Bhakti Sutras intends to remind us that love is just as intense, just as important, just as advanced a doorway to the infinite as the path of Advaita or non-dual awareness. You know, Advaita, which is generally considered to be the jewel of Indian spirituality and, of course, of other spirituality, of other traditions as well. Advaita is the recognition that there's only one suchness, one awareness within everything, and that that awareness is you, that you are that awareness. So, and in Indian spirituality, and especially, I would say, among Western scholars and practitioners who experience the profound sophistication of Indian spirituality, there is often a tendency to believe that jnana yoga, the path of awareness, we can call it, is the be-all, end-all, is the only kind of true method of getting where you want to go. So jnana yoga, again, I know many of you know this, I'm just repeating it for the sake of clarity, really. Jnana yoga means the yoga of knowledge, but not knowledge as intellectual understanding. Knowledge is direct realization of the truth that within and beyond all the forms of awareness is one, all the forms of the world is one great awareness. And the great aphorism of Jnana Yoga is a fairly daunting one, actually. It's in the work of Shankaracharya, the great, who's one of the greatest of all the sages of the Indian subcontinent, who says, only consciousness is real, the world is unreal, and the individual soul, the true self, is consciousness. So, consciousness is real, the world is unreal, the individual soul is consciousness. Actually, another way of saying that, what it actually says is Brahman, the absolute consciousness, is real. The world is unreal, and the individual soul is Brahman. The kicker to this aphorism, which has had a tremendous influence on many, many people who enter this path, is the idea that true awakening, true enlightenment, demands that we give up any relationship with the world of form. Now, the bhakti saints want us to know that this is a misunderstanding, because the truth is, bhakti is a path where you learn to love God as the world. And it's also true that all forms ultimately dissolve into awareness. But even when they're undissolved, even when what we're seeing is this very dense computer, this is what I'm looking at, the trees, your own physical body with all of its aches and pains, nonetheless, these physical things of this world fully contain God. So loving the divine is meant to include loving even your worst traits, even the people who annoy and hurt you, which of course is only possible if you also are ready to realize that you're not separate from the rest of reality. So bhakti is a path of recognizing non-separation, but recognizing non-separation within the context of understanding the uniqueness of forms and honoring the uniqueness of other people, of the forms of God and of the world itself. In that sense, it's what we call in Tantra a dual, non-dual path. In other words, it's both. We acknowledge the basic human experience of being a person, an individual. Why not? It's the truth. We have a unique temperament and personality. We like some things and not others. But while we also realize that there is no separation between your personal energy and the energy that becomes everything else. So getting to that experience is the journey, and that's what we mean by talking about love as a path to awakening. I'm saying this here because it's really important to understand that bhakti is not just feeling. You know, it's not just a kind of mushy romantic tendency to feel good about people in your life and with God. It's also about truth. And if we're not aware that it's also about truth, we're going to get caught up in one of its traps. So, again, let me say something about the traps, because every spiritual approach has some baggage. And the baggage of Jnana Yoga is a kind of a detachment from the world and other people that can actually be unhealthy, that can come from what my guru used to call unskillful renunciation, that is, believing that your human relationships, your work, your material comforts are unimportant and even inimical to spirituality. The baggage of karma yoga is that when you're practicing karma yoga, the yoga of service, it can become very much like any other work you do. You know, it can be like working for an NGO where the goal of the work is altruistic, but you as a worker are completely caught up in busyness, you know, in career issues and trying to do it right, which is great, good, very human, but not karma yoga, which is a path that shows you how to do your actions out of a state of stillness. Now, the baggage of bhakti yoga as a sadhana is fundamentalism. In other words, and we see this in the popular devotional traditions, there's, you know, the most of the popular devotional traditions, religious traditions, are essentially bhakti traditions, and they all have a tendency at certain levels of development to express themselves as a kind of fundamentalism, even fanaticism. That is, my God is the real God and your God is a false God. You know, and we see this, of course, throughout the history of religion. It's what's given religion a bad name. We still see it today. I'm not going to mention any names, but we can probably all think of religious fundamentalists who base their fundamentalism on devotion to a particular form of the divine. And, you know, fundamentalism is a human tendency. It's a normal human tendency. None of us can fully escape it. And there's a stage in our development when we can fall into it easily. And this is another thing we need to understand about ourselves. And it's here that the need for truth is so important. But the truth is that most of our baggage around the path of love comes from our internal contractions, those accumulated psychological wounds and barriers from the unlove that we start to experience. Sometimes as soon as we hear the word love, we start to realize all the ways in which we don't feel that we love enough. And so this is another reason why the jnana experience, where becoming aware of awareness, is hugely important. You know, where you can remind yourself to focus past the thoughts and emotions, past the stories that we tell ourselves, all of us, about what's wrong with our relationships and what's wrong with our love. And remember that, yes, love is real, love is our goal, love is our nature, but our nature is also the pure witnessing awareness. And of course, what we start to realize is that we need both. We need bhakti and jnana. We also need karma. You know, the practice of loving and the practice of remembering the freedom of your own awareness are actually the two wings of the bird of spiritual practice. And that's why the greatest knowers, the philosophers of pure awareness, like Shankara and Abhinavagupta and Aurobindo, the great modern philosopher of consciousness, were also devotees, and why the great devotees like Ramakrishna and my guru were also knowers of truth. Because love and truth are inseparable. Without truth, love for God can become a kind of wallowing emotionalism. Without love, the path of truth becomes dry and disconnected. And another reason why, as bhaktas, it's helpful to have a parallel interest in remembering that our true self is awareness, is that the path of love does actually involve a fair amount of pain along the way. And that when you can remember and recognize awareness as yourself, it actually can help you navigate the feelings of heartbreak and even unlove that devotional practice can bring up. So at this point, let's just take a moment to focus backwards, to take our attention and turn it back to attention itself, to ask ourselves the great question of Jnana Yoga. What is it that knows I'm here? What is it that knows I'm sitting here? What is it that knows I'm listening to Sally? What is it that knows I'm restless, or that I have a stomach ache, or that my heart is full? What is it that knows this? Turn to that. Just let yourself be aware. You are awareness. Yes, your body is filled with intelligence, with feeling, with beauty, with life force. And yet, in your depths, you are awareness. You are that which can't die, and you are love. That which can't die, even when your feeling about your romantic partner seems to die. Love doesn't, because love is you. So let yourself be awareness for just a moment. one of the secrets that I discovered when I first started walking this path, and which some of you have discovered and some of you have been talking about it on the listserv, is that bhakti excavates the heart. And because bhakti practice excavates the heart, because what it actually is doing is digging out the barriers and the veils in your heart, it will often carry with it two very different but very important forms of pain. The first form of pain, which we'll discuss in some depth next week, is what we could call awakened pain, or the pain that comes from yearning for contact with the divine beloved and yet feeling separate, as if with all your effort the beloved can't be reached. There's a metaphor many Christian teachers will use, which is that, as when God wants to bring you close, God will often behave like a mother or a father who's teaching a child to walk. So you hold the child's hand, and as the child gets the hang of it, then the parent starts to move farther away, so the child has to walk through them. So this is very much what happens in the path of bhakti. You get a taste, and then it feels like it's been pulled away, and you have to walk, you have to practice. And that can be painful. And for a really deep bhakta, the pain of not feeling God right next to you, right inside you, can become so acute that, it actually becomes a path in itself, like a motor that brings your heart fully into union. So, and this is what the dark night of the soul is really all about. The famous dark night of the soul, it's about feeling separate from God and yearning to get closer. The second type of pain that bhakti practice brings up is your personal pain, your own woundedness, the suffering of all the heartbreak you've experienced, and the suffering that comes when we start to feel how armored our hearts actually are. So the bhakti path will eventually demand that you let yourself experience that pain in all its fullness, and even learn how to use that pain as a stepping stone into love. And I want to say that there are some of you who are fairly new to this practice, and for those, and when we're new to the practice, very often excavating the heart can be particularly painful, because we actually have to, as it were, take off and move past a lot of veils, and that as the process goes on, the periods of acute pain become less and less. I want to assure you of that. But even later in the path, when we come up against something that that really blocks us, one of the veils, as we'll be speaking about earlier, the suffering can be very acute, and we need to work with that. And we do it by titrating it, as the trauma therapist Peter Levine famously says, and I think someone referred to him on the listserv this week. In other words, to go to the edge of heartbreak, to go to the edge of the pain of our wounds, or the pain of our numbness, and then to recognize the moment when we need to back off so we don't get overwhelmed. So, working with the pain of the heart is a lot like working with any trauma. You need to feel it in order to heal it. But you want to stay in the growth zone rather than the trauma zone, just enough at your edge so that you expand, but not so much that you feel completely groundless. And that said, the bhakti path's tendency to take us through heartbreak is one of the things that makes the path so powerful. Because if you're really in integrity with your love and your desire for love, and if you have at least a part-time interest in truth, then your desire to experience the purest form of love is going to inspire you to interrogate all of your relationships and also the different states of your own heart. And to begin to realize when you're faking it, when you're out of touch with it, when there's neediness that is not helpful. And in other words, you begin to learn what the veils are on the journey. And that's when your friendships, your marriage, your family life really become laboratories for training yourself in the path of love. Ram Dass, who's a great, great teacher of love, very famously said, if you think you're enlightened, go visit your family. And of course, that's exactly true. But that's part of the greatness of the path of love. Because when you come close to someone you are, you know, that's you're very involved with and you don't feel love for them, then what do you do to make yourself shift? What do you do to deal with those feelings? How do you metabolize them? How do you integrate them? So we're going to do a little practice in that regard. You can close your eyes. I like to sit up straight doing a contemplation like this, but it's not really absolutely necessary. And you also might want to keep your journal close to you or a piece of paper just in case an insight comes up that you don't want to forget. So again, be with the breath. And be with the feeling of the breath as that energy that draws love into the body. Now consider a person in your life whom you were close to, and I want to ask you, you want to bring up the first person that comes to mind. Don't go through your Rolodex. Just, I'm asking you this question, bring up someone you're close to whom you love or want to love, but whom you feel criticized by, or whom you criticize, whom you feel disappointed in, or whom you feel is disappointed in you, whom you feel doesn't love you as you feel you would like to be loved. So just bring that person up to your mind and ask yourself, how would it change your experience of this relationship if you were to look at this person as an expression of the beloved in your life? One thing I would tell you, the beloved does not judge or criticize you. So take that off the table. So now imagine this person in front of you in all their human complexity. And again, you don't have to do a really precise visualization, quite the contrary. But what I believe you can all do is get a sense of this person's energy, feel it sitting in front of you. Now imagine that this person's body is filled with light. You may visualize this light or get a sense of it, or you may translate the word light as lightness, as openness, as now connect to your heart through the breath, inhaling and exhaling through the heart. And feel your heart as a receiver. Feel that this person is whispering to you, beloved, beloved, beloved. Can you let yourself receive that? Even if you can't imagine this person speaking this way to you in real life, can you hear their soul reminding you that you are the beloved? And notice what it feels like to receive in your heart the whispers of beloved. And you might, some of you want to write down an insight or a note or two about that experience, about what you experienced. You're going to have an opportunity to come back to this practice during the week. Beloved, you are the beloved. So now let's engage the sutras, sutras 4, 5, 6, and 7 are all about what really happens as you receive the fullness of the beloved as yourself. They really are a promise to us. These sutras are psychoactive. They actually contain a shakti, an energy that has been infused in them by all the great souls who followed this path, because these sutras are actually a pointing out of what the experience of realized love is. So here's Sutra 4, attaining it, divine love. A person becomes a siddha, which means perfected in this context, becomes amrita, becomes immortal, becomes content. Another way of translating this is attaining the realization that you yourself are the beloved. You become perfect. You become immortal. You become endlessly satisfied. So immortal doesn't mean that you live forever in this body. It means that you, of course, learn to identify with the part of you that doesn't die, with love and awareness as yourself. That is what immortality means in yoga. It's recognizing your own innate immortality, which is essentially unkillable, as Krishna says in the Gita. You know, Krishna says to Arjuna at the very beginning, don't think that you could die in this war or that you could kill someone in this war, because the soul of all these beings is immortal. And in the same way, the word perfected, the word siddha, doesn't mean that you suddenly, you know, stop being a klutz, or that you become the best in your profession, or that you never again do anything stupid, you know, or that you never say a mean word to another person in your life. The word that is translated as perfected is siddha, and I want to talk about that for a moment because it's something that's very close to my heart. Those of you who, with whom we were studying the Yoga Sutra earlier this year, know that in Patanjali Yoga Sutra, there's a lot of talk about siddhis, about supernatural powers. And sometimes a siddha, in some traditions, the word siddha is used to describe somebody who has acquired these powers. But that's not what it means in the Bhakti Sutras, and it's not what it means in the deepest way. To be a siddha is to have fully accomplished the goal of yoga, meaning you become one with God as your inner self. In this case, by immersing yourself so completely in devotion that your devotion to God, to the highest, has allowed you to merge completely in the highest form of love. The nature of this immersion in your own self is complete satisfaction. And again, to bring us back to the basics, Yoga 101, really it's the foundational teaching of all forms of yoga and spirituality, is that you can't find rest or satisfaction anywhere other than in the self, anywhere but in the inner experience of divinity. In Swami Prabhavananda's commentary, he quotes a very beautiful statement from the New Testament in which Jesus meets a woman at a well and gives her some water and says, the water that you get from this well will quench your thirst only for a moment, but the living water that you receive from me will quench your thirst endlessly. That's what this means. That love, which is perfect bhakti, is actually what we are always yearning for, and we're yearning for it in everything in life. So when you want something very badly, whether it's a person or a particular outcome or some form of success, and this is a very serious practice, by the way, it's a really good idea to ask yourself, what do I really want by getting what I want? What do I really want by getting what I want? How will I feel if I get what I want? And when you really look into this question, you find that what you want is fulfillment, is that good feeling of enoughness, of needing nothing else because you're able to rest in satisfaction. So what Narada is really saying here is that it is only the nectar of divine love that gives us undying satisfaction. And in my experience, and I know this is true for many of you, when you make that your priority, there is this radical alchemy that takes place. Because as, I don't know if we said it last week, but it's one of my favorite teachings on this topic, that, you know, Abhinavagupta, the great tantric sage, says something that I just think is so radically transformative. He says that universal power that in the cosmos, when acting in the cosmos, is called Shakti. That is the creative power of God. When it appears in an individual, it's called Bhakti. So Shakti and Bhakti are the same. And do you grasp what a big deal that is? You know, that this is this power within love that will actually change the molecules of your body and mind. It'll change the molecules of your consciousness. so that not only are you experiencing the divine within your heart, but you also begin to experience divinity inside your body and even inside your mind, crazy as it sometimes is. So, and you can feel this when you're with somebody who's in that state. Love seeps out of their body and you catch it like measles. And I would say there's lots of different flavors of love. You know, some of you, actually many of you, have that quality of there's love in you. And when we read your posts on the listserv or when we meet you in person, we can feel this love that's just a natural part of your being. The love that we feel from Asiddha, from one of the beings that Narada is talking about in Sutra 4, is of a different order. It's the same, but it's hundreds of times bigger. So, you know, their teachers, when you're around them, who are so pickled in divine love, that bhakti, I mean, the whole full Megillah, the whole nine yards of intoxicating love arises when you're with them. You know, people describe feeling this way around Amma, the hugging saint. Ninkurli Baba, who is the guru of Ram Dass and Krishna Dass, famously had this effect on people. And if you've ever been to one of Krishna Dass's kirtans or heard Ram Dass speak, you know, you actually can feel it because they're able to convey that feeling. Of course, we would feel that way around my teacher, and that feeling was utterly addictive. We would subtly compete with each other to get as close to him as possible because proximity to his physical body was like sitting in front of a blazing fire of love. And I want to say Muktananda was not a soft guy. He was really kind of a hard ass. Tukaram, the poet saint, the Western India, who was one of the great, great poets of the devotional path, once wrote, "We servants of God are softer than butter, but harder than diamonds. We'll give you the coat off our back, but we have no tolerance for fools." And my guru, Muktananda, was exactly like that. His love could melt your heart, but at the same time, he was the toughest and most demanding, not just guru, but boss I ever had. And he had a very hot temper. So very often when I was with him, he would shout at me. He shouted at me many times over the years. And as you can imagine, I really didn't like it. In fact, I often felt he was being unfair or blaming me for something that wasn't my fault. But the thing is, when he shouted, it didn't make me feel shamed, it didn't make me feel bad about myself. In fact, it carried such an energy of love that after one of those encounters, I would walk away feeling as though I'd been injected with ecstasy. And, you know, in later years, when I actually took that drug called MDMA, the drug they call ecstasy, which I did do a couple of times, it's a little bit like that, but much bigger. So, and this is one of the proofs of attainment on this path. You can get it from reading the writings of many of the poet saints. This ability to transmit love just by contagion is a sign that divine love has come so internalized that it's just taken you over. So, and it's that kind of love, that kind that spreads out for you, through your body and affects the environment. It's a sign of being God-infused. And what I've seen is that the very powerful forms of it usually come from practicing with the personal form of the divine. It's not that teachers and realizers of other traditions, other yogas do not transmit love, they do. But this kind of love that can just knock you on your back seems to be a consequence of the devotional path. So there's the Christian mystical teacher Dionysius the Areopagite said, it's the nature of love to change a person into what he loves. In other words, you become divinized. It's one of the reasons, by the way, why this is one of the things that tantric practice aims at, to divinize your whole body, to make you identical with the source, with the mystery. And there's a really good reason for bhakti and tantra, why bhakti and tantra are so aligned. They're so close to each other. And for most of us, you know, as we walk the path, there will be experiences of that, but generally speaking, only for a short while. But as we progress, the sense of the divinity in our own body, mind, becomes more and more our default until we get to the point where it is actually pretty much a complete experience. Bede Griffiths, one of the great Christian mystics of the 20th century, wrote at the end of his life about how after years of his devotional practice, which was focused on Christ, he began to experience his whole body filled with light. And he realized what he was experiencing was something that in the Christian tradition is called transfiguration, where your body becomes transfigured by God energy. And apparently people who came to see him could see that. You know, just as when you've had a really good meditation and you come out of meditation, the people around you can see there's something, you know, they're seeing your soul, they're seeing the light in you. Meister Eckhart says, the soul in her hot pursuit of God becomes absorbed in God, and she herself is reduced to nothing, just as the sun will swallow up the dawn. Some who are so simple as to think of God as if God dwelt up in heaven and of themselves as being down here, I want to say that it is not so. God and I are one. So that's Sutra 4. You become perfect. You become siddha. You become content. You become cooked in love. You become pickled in love. So again, let's breathe in the flow of love that surrounds us. Let it flow through your nostrils, flow down into your chest, into the region of the heart. And then as you exhale, recognize how that love that flows into your body in the form of prana also flows through your cells. Fills your body. Just as God is adoring you through every breath. In Sutra 5, Narada says, having reached that state, a person neither desires anything else, nor grieves, nor hates, nor takes pleasure in anything else, nor is active in pursuit of selfish ends. It is a pretty radical state. And it's not something that you do. You know, the desirelessness of the bhakti state is not imposed. It's not a yogic discipline. It's not a practice of giving things up. It just arises because that feeling is so satisfying that you want nothing else. That feeling is so satisfying that you want nothing else. You need nothing else. You know, desire, of course, comes from lack. And it's one of the characteristics of the human condition, that we're always looking for something else. You're always searching, seeking for the next thing. You know, even after a profoundly tender moment with your beloved, let's say you made love with your beloved and it's been exquisite. And then a few minutes later, you want something. You know, you want something to eat. You want to check your phone for texts. If you're a smoker, you want a cigarette. You know, and this is our natural state. We're always looking for the next fix. the next stimulations. So, but in bhakti, you're experiencing what's called purna kama. Purna means full or fulfilled. Kama means pleasure. Purna kama is the experience of completely fulfilled pleasure. Pleasure that's so fantastic that you can rest in it forever. So my guru, who was very modest about his attainment, was once asked to describe his state. And he said very casually, well, my state is such that I go beyond the mind and senses and I swim in the ocean of bliss. And sometimes I come out of it, but I know how to get back to it. So he was diabetic, and about a year after I met him, he had a diabetic seizure. His diabetes apparently had not been treated, and he nearly died. And as he was being carried on a stretcher to an ambulance, he said to the person accompanying him, he said, Guru told the truth. He always said this bliss is undying. And it's true. It doesn't go away, even when your body's in agony. This bliss is undying. Well, he used to talk a lot about the state of his siddhas. And one of the things he said was, he talked about how when he was young, he traveled through India, and what he was always doing was going to meet great beings, great saints. And he said that he would come across these beings and they would be laughing, and then they would fall silent, and then they would laugh again, because their experience of bliss was such that it kept arising in new forms and making them laugh again. So as Sutra 6 says, having known this, one becomes ecstatic. One becomes stunned. One comes to delight in the self. One of the great descriptions of this state is in Shankaracharya, my mind, like a hailstone, has fallen into the ocean of bliss. The ego has disappeared. I have realized my identity with Brahman, and so all my desires have melted away. And in Sutra 7, Narada continues by saying, this love does not arise from desire, because its nature is to become still, to become nirodha, some of you will remember from the Yoga Sutra, means the cessation of thought, of the cessation of desire. As Ann Wisler wrote in the listserv yesterday, love is the great refining power that heals everything. Steep in love and be healed. As we do the practice that leads to this state, traditionally we start with our relationships. Our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with others, our relationship with parents, because these are the laboratory in which we learn to expand the heart. And one of the ways that we actually know we're progressing in the bhakti path is that we begin to be able to let go of judgments about the other people in our lives and appreciate them. Let's direct appreciation to ourselves. This is an expansion of the practice we did a few minutes ago, but we're going to make it more directed. So imagine yourself seated in a shady grove on a warm summer evening. Your eyes are closed. Your body is very relaxed. The breath is flowing very easily. and you're aware that the air around you is suffused with this very subtle feeling of tenderness. This place where you're seated is a very sacred place. And it's a place where you're going to meet the form of the divine, who actually wants to show you how much you are appreciated. Recognize that there's a being seated in front of you. Maybe it's a form of the Divine Mother. Maybe it's someone you know. Maybe it's Christ or Buddha or one of the modern sages like Ramakrishna. Or maybe it's Krishna. Or maybe there's no recognizable form, but simply a sense of presence. Feel yourself seated in front of a being who is the very incarnation of grace, of divine love. No matter what state your heart is in at this moment, this being is sending love into you with the intention of filling you with appreciation, with affection. Feel that being saying to you, you are loved. You are held in love. You are seen in all your beauty and in all your apparent imperfection. And every part of you is adorable to me. Let yourself receive that love. And now notice that the more you can receive love from this divine being, the more you can offer it to the world. So as you let yourself breathe in the feeling of being held in love, open the pores of your body and let your exhalation pour affection into the world. Just let that happen in a very natural way. As you feel loved, you're able to offer love. It just is natural. So what the yoga tradition tends to believe and what we tend to believe when we begin to practice yoga in the tradition is that this kind of love, this unconditional love, is not only of a higher order than ordinary love, it also belongs to God, not to our humanness. And even when we understand intellectually that our humanness and our godness are not different, nonetheless, there often is a tendency to separate human love, which of course is full of all kinds of particularity and is often the source of suffering, from divine love, which is unconditional, which is pure, which is universal. Which often, you know, often in the West we talk about agape as love that encompasses all, and eros, which is love that is directed often erotically, often romantically or sexually, towards a particular person. And often in the traditional ways we talk about this, it's believed that this kind of love is less than, because it contains desire. So there's a very famous story that I love a lot about the sage Tulsidas, who wrote the Hindi version of the Ramayana. Now, Tulsidas in his early days was hopelessly in love with his wife, and his love was very, very sexual. He wanted to make love to her all the time. And it seems that his wife was not as enthusiastic about he was with making love all day and all night. And at one point she decided that she needed a break from all this attention, and she told Tulsidas that she was going to go spend a few weeks with her family. So as she went, her family lived in the next village. And after a couple of days, Tulsidas missed her so much that he decided he had to be with her. So he began to walk towards the village. Now, it was in the story, it's monsoon, so there is a driving rainstorm, and if you've ever been in a monsoon rainstorm in India, you know that this is a big rainstorm. The river was, he had to cross a river. The river was in flood. He got swept downstream and managed to pull himself to the other shore with enormous effort. So his clothes were in rags. He's battered. He's exhausted. He finally gets to his wife's house, his wife's parents' house. He sees what looks like a rope hanging from her window. And he climbs up the rope, knocks on her window, and when she opens it and he falls into the room, they both realize that what he thought was a rope was actually a cobra. And she says, "What are you doing here?" And Tulsi says, "I miss you so much. I had to see you." And his wife said, "If you would direct one quarter of that intensity towards God, as you do towards me, you'd be enlightened by now." And the story goes that this was Tulsi's wake-up call, and that from that moment he made the decision that rather than directing this intense, infatuated love towards his wife, he would direct it towards Rama, and he became a one-pointed lover of God in the form of Rama. I mean, we don't really know, the story doesn't tell us what happened to his relationship, but chances are that they stayed married and hopefully enjoyed each other, but in a less obsessive form. But in any case, this is a classic traditional story about the evolution of love, about what's sometimes called the evolution of love. So love, as the bhakti teachers say, will start out as an attached, sometimes very often egoic love for one person, driven by sexual attraction or neediness or the desire to be cared for. But the implication is that this level of love is always intrinsically selfish, driven by the need and desire for personal satisfaction, which is a very, very human quality, not one we should demonize, but it's not really the goal of yoga. So the move in the bhakti tradition is that you redirect your personal attached, desire-driven feelings of love to a higher or wider or greater object, towards a divine form, towards the formless presence that encompasses all that is, or inward towards the heart. So whatever your feeling is, you direct it towards the divine. And this is when, as we've been saying, this automatic alchemy happens that begins to transform you. Rumi says, "God is pleased when your love realizes that it's part of something oceanic and begins to move with the wholeness. This larger love is more real because it's itself the reality." And yet, if there's one thing that I've come to realize in my life as a seeker, the evolution of love is a spiral. And Rumi also says, God's love moves from unmarked box to unmarked box. It moves through every possible form of affection. And it learns its own vastness not only by emptying itself of attachment, but also by sampling the many flavors and types of loving. You know, there is indeed a type of one-pointed awakening to inner love that makes human physical love seem irrelevant. I had that type of awakening myself in my early 30s when the awakening to love as an inner force became so alluring that I found most other relationships distracting. You know, my friends used to ask me how I could be celibate, and I would say because the inner feeling is so much more interesting than anything that goes on between me and another person, and it was true. It was a very powerful experience. It brought a kind of automatic yogic discipline that I didn't have to strive for. But the truth is, and I came to realize this as the years went on, is that just as love is not complete when it focuses on another person, it's also not complete when it focuses entirely on the inner experience. We really do need to let go of the old dichotomy between divine love and human love, and between the love we feel towards another person and let the love that wells up spontaneously from inside, you know, as a gift of grace. When the heart opens, of course, it opens under particular circumstances. For instance, most of us have an easier time opening the heart to some people than to others. Or we find it easier to open the heart while we're singing or chanting or in community. And it's important to pay attention to that because the situations that trigger love in us are clues. We can use them to find this pathway back to love, even when we're not feeling it. But once you start to work with loving as a practice and start to become aware of how your personal feeling pathway works, you'll notice that when you're really in touch with love, it's going to spill over into everything. As we started to talk about last week, there are really at least four kinds of love and that actually need to be integrated. First, there's personal love, the feeling you have for the people you're closest to, which is often, for some of us, a fairly small list. Though the more your heart expands, the more people you can feel close to. Secondly, love is this general feeling of openness towards kind of everyone you come across, everything you come across, the beings who show up during your day, including strangers. Third, the feelings of love that connect us to nature, with all that that means. And fourth, the feeling of love for and from the divine. The feeling of being in a reciprocal relationship with an invisible skein of blessing, which you open to in order to receive, and then you also open to offer back into the invisible. And, you know, in that, just as you learn to dialogue with other people, you learn to dialogue with the invisible, to ask for help and blessing, to hear the promptings of the heart, to offer gratitude and service. And yet the truth is that every one of these types of love, including love for God, can function as a veil. It can function as, let's say, a kind of comfort zone where we settle in and feel like we've got what we want. And then refuse to move deeper or further. I'm going to read you a poem of Rumi's that's actually quite a beautiful esoteric explanation of what it means to allow your love to evolve to deeper and deeper levels. Here's what he says. This is love, to fly towards heaven, to rend every instant 100 veils, the first moment to renounce life, the last step to walk without feet, to regard the world as invisible, not to see what appears to be. O heart, I said, may it bless thee to have entered the circle of lovers, to look beyond the range of the eye, the EYE, to penetrate the windings of the bosom. O heart, may it bless thee to have entered the circle of lovers, to look beyond the range of the eye, to penetrate the windings of the bosom. So this first line, to fly towards heaven, flying is actually a word that Rumi, in many of his poems, uses to express the feeling of this journey, which is a feeling of lightness. It's actually love is buoyant. You know, it rises. It carries you to a kind of ascension. It makes everything light. And heaven is a metaphor for that. But here's the part that I think is really important. It's the second line, to rend every instant 100 veils. The veils are the illusions of form, whatever that form may be, essentially the blocks that separate you from the beloved. So in the act of committing ourselves to the path of love, we are consciously or unconsciously committing ourselves to focusing our gaze on what lies beyond the visible, beyond our karmic circumstances. In other words, what love always does is dissolve separation. You know, Narada in Sutra 7 says bhakti doesn't arise from desire because it has the nature of stillness, of nirodha. And that's what Rumi is saying here, to regard this world as invisible, to see past the appearance. To regard this world as invisible, to see past the appearance. When the mind is still, of course, the physical and mental worlds don't appear to be separate from you. And what Rumi is saying is that the physical world is itself a kind of veil. One of the physicists at the very famous studies done at the Santa Fe Institute in the last 10 years wrote a book in which he says that what we see with our eyes are actually icons, like the icons on the computer. You know, they're not the real deal. The trees outside are not really what they look like. They're icons for a particular configuration of energy, and if we can remove our sense of the appearance, we'll see the energy behind them. Or, you know, and of course, this means removing some big veils. I think one of the reasons that people are so blown away by psychedelic drugs like psilocybin is that psilocybin does something in the brain which actually removes the veil that makes you see the appearance of the world and lets you see into it. So this is what Rumi is talking about. And on the day-to-day, to those of us on the path, I feel that these lines, especially Rumi's version, to rend 100 veils, points to what I would call the deepest strategy of using love as your vehicle to God. And it, you know, when you're fully following the path of love, to have the intention to see beyond appearances, and by appearances I don't just mean physical bodies, I mean the way situations seem to be. You know, the way certain things will happen in your relationships and you'll start feeling like a victim or you'll start feeling like you're a bad person. These are appearances. So when we're focused on rending the veils, what we look for is the connectedness, the love energy behind all this. So for instance, when you've fallen in love with somebody or just have a feeling of warmth for another person, you can ask yourself, what is it I really love in this person? What is it that really attracts me? And it's a really interesting question because definitely when we're drawn to people, there's a part of it that has everything to do with, you know, how they talk or how they look or how, you know, how we feel about them personally. This is natural and normal. But the thing is, when we let our love be limited by these factors, our love is quite fragile. It's liable to slip away if the person hurts us. Or even for more trivial reasons, you know, when I was 19, my boyfriend was drafted, which we had the draft in those days, and when he came back from basic training, he had a military haircut. Now, this guy had incredibly good hair. He had thick black hair that I really loved and that made his face very beautiful. And when I first saw him with his military haircut, I was so shocked by his appearance that I felt my love completely draining away. And, you know, very embarrassing. I got used to the haircut, of course, but I also realized how partial my love for him was. And, you know, I think if I'd known to ask myself what I really loved about him, that question would have prompted me to look past the surface. And this is part of what Rumi means by rending the veils. It's what we're always doing, what we always have to do when we're willing to let our relationships be pointers on the path of love. So you're always doing your best to see through the superficial aspects of what you love, and also through the superficial aspects of your own love, of your own capacities. You know, in human love, you see the uniqueness of that particular person, the reasons why you love that person. And you also learn to see the shining essence in them that's not different from your own shining essence. So when we want to get close to somebody, to see into them, to let them see into you, when we want the deepest possible intimacy, what we come to realize is that the intimacy we're longing for is yearning for the beloved, and that it is possible to yearn for and merge with the beloved appearing in another person. But we have to recognize that this is what we long for, because until we realize that that's what we want is soul to soul, not exclusive soulmate relationship, but any moment when we're in soul-to-soul contact with someone who doesn't have to be a lover, who doesn't have to be a child, who doesn't have to be someone close to us. It can be anybody if we can look into their eyes and touch that soul. So one of the veils that we rend on our journey towards divine love is the veil of specificity, the veil that tells ourselves, that tells us that this individual is the source of our love, or that only this feeling is love. But a veil can also be an internal veil, and of course that's more common. A belief or an emotional block, you know, maybe the feeling of numbness that hides an early childhood wound, or the feeling of being rejected that can happen when you know somebody looks at you a weird, some kind of funny way, and triggers your internal sense of not being loved enough. Or, as some of you have been discussing on the list, of the veil of judgment. So what Rumi means when he says penetrating the windings of the bosom, he's actually talking about penetrating into the heart of the emotions, the beliefs, the ideas, the feelings that veil the heart, including the ones that feel really good. You know how it is when you had a wonderful time with somebody and that happened 3 weeks ago, but somehow you're not really able to be fully present with them now because you want it to be like it was 3 weeks ago. That's a veil. And of course, some of these veils feel terrible, like the memories of rejection or trauma or numbness that closes our heart so that we begin to feel like we're not capable of loving. So on the path of love, as we move through these veils, we actually have to have the courage to let ourselves experience the discomfort of rending them. Especially when we get to the higher and subtler levels of the path, when we can experience the acute pain of separation from the beloved. But that pain, and this I believe is what Rumi was saying, that pain can function as a Dharma bell that shows you how you are limiting love. So I want to tell you another personal story. Thank you for indulging me in this. Because what love really does, when once you decide to use your human emotions as pointing out instructions to show you what is veiling the potential of your love, then even experiences that feel heartbreaking can open you up to that. So years ago, I developed a massive crush on somebody with whom there was no possibility of actualizing or consummating it. And it was quite painful. I mean, if you know the suffering of you know, love that can't be expressed, you know it's one of the most painful things there is. And one morning I was sitting in meditation and I started to think about this person in a very loving way and also with a lot of a kind of combination of sadness and also a feeling of wanting to help and serve him. And I was kind of wallowing in the emotionalism of my affection. And suddenly I became aware that the crown of my head had opened and that love was pouring into me from above. Literally like streams of love pouring into my head and pouring down into my heart. And I felt very powerful and personal. And I mean really personal. And I found myself asking, who's loving me? Who's the source of this feeling? You know, is this Shiva? Is this the guru? And as I asked the question, my awareness shifted to the space behind my breastbone, and the same powerful feeling began to gush up from in my heart like a fountain. And along with it, the awareness, this love comes from God, and this love is within you. And this was the moment when I actually internalize the teaching that is the heart of the non-dual traditions, that love comes from within. You know, we can hear this teaching over and over again, and we all have, but until we have an actual internal realization of it, a demonstration, we don't really get it, because it's only that experience that rends the veil that keeps us thinking that love is coming from somewhere else, that we need an actual person in order to feel love. And at that point, you know, at the very ultimate point, even the form of the divine becomes a veil, because what love wants to do is dissolve all separation. We're going to do one more meditation, one final meditation. I want to ask you, we're going to do this in the homework, but just at this moment, let me bring this thought to your attention. Have you ever had an experience that heartbreak or unrequited love or loss can turn you towards the source of love? It's an interesting thing to contemplate, because I think Many of us have had that experience of how heartbreak, the pain of separation, really is itself a path, just as joy is itself a path. You know, that every feeling, every emotion can be a pointer to love. Whether love is conditioned or unconditioned, your love has the same basic nature and is a portal to the infinite. Close your eyes. Allow your body to come into a upright posture. We're going to meditate for a little longer. So consider, as we did last week, what kind of love do you most long for? Nurturing love, romantic love, love that can be extended to all beings. And now ask, is there love present here? Can I receive it now? And now feel that your heart opens like the shutter of a camera. Your forehead opens like the shutter of a camera. Your belly opens like the shutter of a camera. The whole front of your body is subtly opened for love to pour in. You are being breathed by love. You are being thought by love. You are being loved by love. You are being moved by love. And as the breath flows in as love through the heart, feel that the back of your heart opens also. And that as you inhale love, it flows in through the center of your heart, flows out through the back, and then draws in a vast energy of love back into your body. You're breathing into the heart, letting the heart open backwards to the energy of the great heart, the energy of the vastness, which supports and upholds you. And with the inhalation, drawing it back into your heart, and then exhaling it so that it spreads through your whole body. It might take you a minute or two to find this way of breathing such that the breath can move through the body. Keep inhaling until, as it draws in the vastness of the energy behind you, let love breathe you. Let love connect you to the vastness that is what you are. Let love draw that vastness into your inner heart. And then with the exhalation, release that love so it flows through your body and fills you from head to toe, flowing outward into the room around you, let yourself breathe love. Let yourself be loved. We'll sit in this awareness for a few more minutes. And then the music will come on. Meditate on the flow of love.
Balam Radhi. Govinda Bala Radhi.
Yeah.